week, we're joined together in welcoming Alison Brie and Dave Franco, stars of Together. And we chat to the Materialists girl, that movie's writer-director, Celine Song. All that plus usual news and nonsense on the movie podcast. It turned its back for 1 week. 1 week! I was away for 1 week! And somehow, in my absence, Alex Godfrey launched a modelling career?
He would be here today, but he's shooting a Diet Coke advert with Jamie Dornan. So.
Even now, he's deploying La Tigra. He's like, I've got Ferrari in my back pocket. Would you like that? Unbelievable. We'll explain that in 2 seconds. But hello, pod. I'm Chris Hewitt. Welcome to the Emperor podcast. This week, no Helen O'Hara, no James Dyer. They are both away. But don't worry, folks. I have replaced them seamlessly with another woman.
Yeah, that's what they call me.
Hello.
Other woman.
And another bald man. I'm on one.
Spin your eyes, I guess.
A woman and a woman.
A woman and a woman. Absolutely. Welcome both. How are you all?
Yeah, fantastic.
Good.
Thanks. Again, just very sorry that we're here and not... certified
no,
hunk.
No, Jesus. No. Well, certified hunk Alex Godfrey is one thing. But can I just say, in terms of the Helen James thing, you guys are upgrades.
Like,
major league upgrades. I am so sick of their shit and their stupid fucking faces. So I'm very, very glad that you're both here.
Thank you, I guess.
Next week when they're back, or actually James isn't back for weeks, but next week I'll be like, I am so sick of Amon and Beth. Luckily they don't listen to the podcast, so we are good. So what's this business about Alex launching a modeling career?
I wish I didn't listen to the podcast after last week, should be honest. So for context, yes.
Context. I've been away. I can't help.
For goodness sake.
You know what it's like? I was with family last week, and you know, and when people say context, it just in normal life, I can't do it. I can't go contrutext. I can't go wander. Whenever someone says wander, it's being with real people in the real world is really, it's enervating. Anyway, but
you were really brave. You were really brave to make that week work.
Such a brave boy. Anyway.
So stepping in for you last week was Alex Godfrey, who's on the podcast a fair few times.
Yeah.
But I think some of our like video coverage of the podcast hit a certain...
We're doing more video stuff on promos, you know, like what do young people say? I'm on...
Socials.
Mm. Yeah, the social promos.
Yes. So let's say that video footage hit a certain fan base because...
Was a certain fan base, women of a certain age?
It's unclear. I mean, I'm looking at a comment from somebody, Herdzilla. It's unclear. It's a very small avatar, so I apologize. But it was screen grabbed and shared in the Empire group that just said, my goodness, Alex Godfrey is a hunk. And then there was something of a congregation, I think, on our Reddit, or so maybe there's a subreddit now, I used to say, of people exclusively coming to the subreddit to discuss Alex.
Wow.
This is amazing.
I was going to do Mike Rushmore for this week's question, but I might do Fuck, Marry, Kill instead.
No, I will kill myself. I will set myself on fire before I have to answer any of those questions.
No, I don't want to answer those questions either. Because weirdly, the answer to all of them is Alex.
The man with it all. Oh my goodness.
Anyway, so there was a video of Alex talking about something. Was it weapons? And this has got a certain demographic hot under the collar. Having to have their medication changed as a result. This is wild. Well, hey, listen, this could happen to any one of us, with the notable exception of me. This could happen to any of us. Who knows what clip we'll release this week.
Good Lord.
Amon, I can see you've already you're looking sultry.
Thank you. It's flexing. Everyone's pointing in various directions. Sort of, I might just put a fan on me so my hair's like blowing in the wind.
I'm a single dude, so bring that attention my way, why don't you?
Yeah. Beth, put the guns away, honestly, come on.
Just pointing, people might not know where the door is.
Just look at this.
People might not know where all the emergency exits are. I'm just being really helpful.
Oh, the gun show? I think it's that way.
What would you name your guns? You know, people have nicknames for them, don't they? I'm trying to think what mine would be.
What would my nickname for my arms be?
Yeah.
Army and, oh no, I was going to say Army and Hammer, but maybe not.
Oh no. Let's move on. No, we don't. Let's move on.
Anyway, welcome to the Empire Podcast. The old magic's still there. anyway, welcome. How are you both? Genuinely, you okay? You good?
Oh, we're doing this, yeah, I guess.
Yeah, we're doing this.
Yeah.
Too
contractually
hot.
Obliged. I know it's warm and it's just warm generally in England at the moment. And
I prefer that over the alternative. I do not have a good relationship with the cold.
Do you not?
No, we're not on speaking terms.
Really?
No. Okay. But the heat, I'm all for the heat. I wear my shades, it's all good.
Yeah, future's so bright, you got to wear shades. I'm on.
Yeah,
and I'm buttoned 3 buttons. I know you've got your sip is coming down. just a little hint of the valley of pleasure. All right, okay, I see what you're doing. I'm pointing cameras away from you. Should we have a question?
Yeah.
All right, so I, in James and Helen's absence, I thought, you know what, now is the time to do a Mount Rushmore without the two of them moaning. Helen specifically. Helen, for some reason, does not like the Mount Rushmore questions. Like, she does them. She throws herself into them wholeheartedly, but whenever the topic comes up, she's like, oh.
Well, how many have you guys done at this stage?
Actually, probably not that many. I mean, okay. I don't keep a spreadsheet, but probably 12 over the last couple of years we started doing them.
Okay.
I don't know. It's not like, we don't do it every week. Mm. But I thought, you know, while the cat's away, the mouse will play. So I asked people for Mount Rushmore questions and potential topics to suggest. And one that I have, I think, lighted on is, I'm just trying to find it, final girls in horror movies. Here we go. From Captain Malcolm on Twitter. With Alien Earth releasing this week, it's got me thinking about Ellen Ripley, of course. So Mount Rushmore of final girls. Interestingly enough, someone has replied to this with what I think is pretty much the definitive Mount Rushmore of final girls. So I'll be interested to see if we land on this person's choice.
Well, I'm anticipating some classics, and I've purposely gone more contemporary with mine.
Okay. Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
All right. So we should explain very quickly how this is going to work. So it's Mount Rushmore. We're going to put one face up on the mount, the big old mount, per person, and we're going to have a collective choice at the end, because there are only 3 of us.
Mm.
There are 4 faces to go on that big old mountain. So, Beth, contemporize me.
Go on, then. Lupita Nyong'o and Us.
Oh! Hello, final girl and evil villain killer type thing as well. Yeah.
Huge.
All right. I like the choice.
Chilling. Absolutely chilling.
I'll say it once again. The fact that she was not Oscar nominated for that performance is a travesty.
But what was it? It was last year. There were so many Oscar-worthy performances in horror movies. And should we explain, first of all, what a final girl is for those who don't know? We've just jumped into this.
Yeah.
What is a final girl?
Well, I was hoping you'd tell me. I just assumed it's someone who's the last standing, who's outsurvived the other characters.
That is it.
Oh, great.
It's very simple.
I thought it was like survived the film. But if it's outsurvive other characters.
The final girl, I mean, generally speaking, you would like your final girl to survive the film.
Mm.
Some final girls survive the film and then get bumped off very quickly in the next film. That can happen. But say, for example, so Marion Crane is not a final girl.
Mm.
But you're saying Lupita Nyong'o's character in Us is.
Yeah.
What's her character name? Do you remember that? Addie. Mm-hmm. Addie. And it's, I guess it's, she's not a final girl in the traditional sense of final girls tend to be slasher movies where people are being picked off one by one until there's literally one character left. And that's not what happens in Us.
No.
But I will allow it because it's a fantastic choice. That's great. I like that. But final girls tend to be... So in the original Friday the 13th, there's a character called Alice, I believe, played by Adrienne King.
Mm.
And she is very much not the prototypical final girl, because there were final girls before that, including one we'll discuss, I'm sure. But she is very, very famously the final girl of that movie. And that last 10, 15 minutes of that movie is all her running away from the evil killer, who in that movie is not, of course, as we all know, Jason Voorhees. It's his mum. You Mrs. Freeze. And she's a great final girl, and she gets bumped off in the first 5 minutes of the next movie. So
yeah.
Harsh.
There we go. Harsh, but fair. So we would say, Jason Voorhees. It's like, you killed my mum. The fuck? Retribution's coming your way. Amon, you've had time to think.
Sydney Prescott in Scream.
Okay, the QI klaxon is going on right now because that is one of the names on this gentleman's list.
Saw that.
But, but that is a cracking choice. Sydney Prescott, played, of course, by?
Neve Campbell.
That is correct. In?
Scream 1, 2, 4.
Why would you skip 3?
Scream 1, 2, 3, and 4.
Uh-huh.
There's one that she's not in. I can't remember.
That's right.
Most recent one.
Yeah,
right?
Scream 6.
Yeah.
She's not in Scream 6.
Yeah.
But she's coming back for the next Scream.
Yeah. She's in 2 movies called Scream and 3 movies that aren't called Scream. She's in other movies that aren't called Scream at all. I just want to say that. But Sydney Prescott, yes, one of the great final girls. So that means that one of the four names that's on Jake Stevo's list, that I would say would be pretty much the definitive list of final girls, we're not going to name at least one of those characters. I'm not going to go for Ripley, because even though Ripley does tick a lot of boxes, and Alien is a horror film, everything that comes after kind of isn't. I can't not go for Ash from Evil Dead 2.
Here he goes.
I mean, Final Girl was stretching it a little bit, but I'm going to go for Laurie Strode.
Yes.
Who is Jamie Lee Curtis's character from the Halloween movies. And she's been through it.
Oh, yeah.
Very much so.
She's been through it as well. She's been through the old ringer. So pursued by Michael Myers across a whole number of films and different timelines.
Yep.
As well, which gets exhausting after a while. So obviously Halloween, then Halloween. So again, like Neve Campbell, she's been in 2 films called Halloween. Halloween 2. Then Halloween 2 was retconned out of existence by the David Gordon Green movies. So this is all very interesting. So the through line for Laurie Strode initially is Halloween 2.
Yeah.
Then she doesn't appear, no one appears in Halloween 3, which is his own thing. It's a sort of anthology movie.
Yeah.
Then there's Halloween 4, 5, and 6, which is a kind of Return of Michael Myers, Revenge of Michael Myers, all that sort of stuff. And those movies, Laurie Strode is dead.
Right.
But she dies off screen. We're told that she is dead. But then she came back in Halloween H2O.
Best horror name.
Which is, I love it. Because you meant to say H20.
Oh,
I'm pretty sure you meant to say H20.
Oh,
but
I always say H2O.
I always say H2O. Halloween Water, right? So she comes back for Halloween Water with a great cast, Michelle Williams, Josh Hartnett, you know.
That is so confusing.
That's how you keep track of these things. So she comes back. Now, I believe that there's a clever get out of jail free card, which is that she faked her death. Because she went into witness protection program, so Michael Myers wouldn't harass her. But of course, he finds her, tracks her down. Halloween H2O, which is really good film.
Mm.
And then she kills Michael Myers at the end of that movie, or does she?
Mm.
Because it made a lot of money, so they came back again for Halloween Resurrection, and she gets killed this time. Mm-hmm. She dies in the opening sequence of that movie, which is all very, very sad. And that was it. That was all she wrote for Laurie Strode. And then, of course, David Gordon Green comes he comes knocking on your door, because there was obviously Rob Zombie movies as well, which are actually okay. I'm not a big fan of Rob Zombie as a horror as a filmmaker, full stop. But those films, there's a scuzzy quality to them, but there's actually some decent stuff in them. And Scout Taylor Compton played Laurie Strode in those movies. But in the rebooted David Gordon Green movies, which then retcon everything after Halloween out of existence, she's back as Laurie Strode in Halloween Kills and Halloween Ends. So just for sheer endurance.
I mean, I love Jamie Lee Curtis's performances in those films, especially the later ones, even though I don't think the later films quite kept up with that performance and her potential as that character.
Especially Halloween Kills, which I think is the big misstep of that trilogy. But
yeah, but always a thrill to see her back in that character and seeing what she can do with that character, and especially with the agency that she was afforded with that new trilogy and what she could bring to it as a woman who's been through decades worth of experience in Hollywood.
And as a woman of a certain age as well, by the time we pick up with her again, it's Laurie Strode, and you know, she doesn't have the signature Jamie Lee Curtis haircut in those three movies. She's sidelined a lot in Kills. She's really good in the first Halloween.
Yeah.
And Halloween Ends as well, which I've got a real soft spot for. But I think probably the best thing about those movies was the Jamie Lee Curtis press tours that followed, because that lady does not give a fuck.
Oh, no.
And is brilliant. Also, the pronunciation of the word trauma, I think, has haunted us all. Yeah, trauma.
Yeah, it took on life of its own.
Yeah, very much so. So, all right. So we're three final girls down on Mount Rushmore. We have Addie from Us. We have Sydney Prescott, and we have Laurie Strode from Halloween, Jamie Lee Curtis vintage. Who do we want to put up as our collective choice on there?
Collective choice.
I feel like we're going to skew classic, aren't we?
All ears. I'm open to all suggestions. This is a democracy.
There's one more recent one which I don't know if it...
Oh, go on. Who is it?
I really liked Samara Weaving in Ready or Not.
That's on my list as well, to be fair.
Good choice. What's the character name again? Remind me.
Grace Le Domas.
Oh, very good. Yeah.
But yeah, she thinks she's getting married to her dream guy, and then she gets drawn into this sadistic family game that she has to fight her way out of. And it's really, really cool to see her dress gets slowly more shredded as the film goes on.
Yeah.
And then in the final 20 minutes when she's just killing everybody, it's really, really cool.
And she goes through it as well. I rewatched really it does. Recently. She gets like, she puts her hand on a nail and she has to pull herself up with her full weight on the hand on the nail. And she has the most incredible like battle cry, which is an incredible performance. It was a real like, what the hell is this? Who the hell is she? In terms of like a new entry, and she was on my list as well. I also had...
Who else we got?
I had Florence Pugh and Midsommar.
Florence Pugh and Midsommar.
Imagine that face on Rushmore, adorned in all of those flowers, with that real like unhappy little like... Or the little smile at the end. I mean, aesthetically, I think it works. And
I still haven't watched that film.
Oh my goodness.
I couldn't, because that was after Hereditary, and Hereditary scarred me so badly that that was like a go to church the next day and get right with God type film. Hereditary.
Oh, okay.
I think I was, accurate stories of me praying during that screening. That
How
freaked out I was. And I couldn't.
Are you a religious man, or did you just find religion in the middle of that film? God, if you're there, I'm sorry for everything I said.
No, I'm a religious man, but I redevoted myself to Christianity after that. Honestly,
oh my God.
It's a crazy film. So I know that I need to watch it. I just haven't been able to bring myself. And Florence Pugh is like incredible. I'm sure it's great, but it's just like
I don't know that she ticks the final girl boxes.
Why?
I mean,
she survives them all. She
traditionally, I'm thinking slashers. People being picked off one by one, final
That's
girl
what happens
running
in Midsommar.
Around. Yeah, it doesn't, it doesn't, it doesn't. It doesn't, it doesn't. I'm on.
I don't watch much horror, did I mention that?
No, I know, but this is why it's funny.
Because
you have gone through the ringer with I've sat next to you in some horror films. It's quite a fun experience.
For you, maybe.
Yeah.
You say we can't mention.
So, have you seen any of the classics? Have you seen any? Have you seen a Friday the 13th movie? Have you seen a Halloween? Have you seen a Nightmare on Elm Street?
Seen Halloween.
Uh huh.
Haven't seen Friday the 13th. Have not seen Nightmare on Elm Street.
You haven't seen Nightmare on Elm Street?
No.
Oh my goodness.
No. Interesting.
Those are really scary, though. No.
Like, again, in my household growing up, my mum would not let me anywhere near that sort of thing.
Really?
Hell no.
Okay.
No.
Okay.
And also, like, I'm just a scaredy cat. Like, it took me... Here's how much of a pretty cat I am. It took me a long while to be able to watch Michael Jackson's Thriller video all the way through. Literally, that's like one of the first things that fully freaked me out. I couldn't look at it properly because it's like, oh, what was this? Yeah. Sorry.
Well, that's afraid you are, and you're banging the microphone and you tend to get out of here. All right. Well, in case you haven't seen Nightmare on Elm Street, but I am going to suggest this is one of the names on this person's Mount Rushmore list. Nancy Thompson, who is the Heather Langenkamp heroine from the original Nightmare on Elm Street. She also shows up in Nightmare on Elm Street 3, Dream Warriors, which for some people is the best of the franchise.
That's the best. That's the one that always gets me there with the
The puppet. It's grisly. Yeah. So Freddie, you know the basic idea behind Nightmare on Elm Street, or do I have to explain it to you? Freddy Krueger.
Okay.
Does that name ring a bell to you?
I've heard of him.
Okay.
Yeah.
One, two, Freddy's coming for you.
Oh, is that a song?
Three, four, better lock your door. Five. Actually, it's sung by little children, so it's creepier. Going, they're like, five, six, grab a crucifix.
So you can control children.
Seven, eight, gonna stay up late. Never sleep again. Freddy Krueger is a child killer. But hear me out.
It was actually quite a sweet song.
It's sung by in the dream. Okay, so Freddy haunts your dreams.
Okay.
He haunts your nightmares. And he is a child killer in real life. Well, not real life, but in the real life of the movie. I'm explaining this badly. Anyway,
have you seen Treehouse of Horror?
He's got... Jeez, how have you not... Now, I'm going to start praying in a second. He has knives for fingers, right? So he has a glove. He has a razor-sharp knives, or razors, probably, that he used to kill children. Okay. And then... one day, the parents of the town that he was doing this in, they were like, "Oi, stop that, dickhead." So they ganged up on him, vigilante style, killed him, burned him alive. Mm-hmm. All right. But he was so evil because, Amon, he's the bastard son of 100 maniacs, or maybe 1,000 maniacs. Wow. Anyway, there were a lot of maniacs involved in his conception. All right.
Mm-hmm.
Not a nice guy.
I'm getting that.
So evil that he manages to kind of re-manifest himself in the dream world as a man who can haunt the dreams of the children of the people who killed him. And he can manifest himself in their dreams as this sweater-wearing, razor-clawed, pizza-faced, you know that gag in Deadpool about, Freddy Krueger face-fucked a topographical map of Utah?
I remember it.
That's because Freddy Krueger has a sort of burned, scarred face, played by Robert Englund.
And if he kills the kids in their dreams,
they die in real life. And then in the original 1984 movie, it's all very icky and fairly low budget, but Wes Craven was a genius and tapped into something really primal. And the deaths are kind of... low-key, really. And then as Freddy became more popular, he became the star of the films, and he started becoming a bit of a one-liner dispenser as well, and being played for comic effect. And the kills became really over-the-top and quite imaginative. So in Nightmare on Elm Street 3, Dream Warriors, do you remember when we started talking about this 10 minutes ago? There's one of the kids that he kills. He slices down their arms and their legs, takes their fangs out of their body, and then puppets them around.
Whoa.
But it's the sound design. It's
horrible
beat of the blood going through the veins. It is actually making me feel quite ill.
Yeah.
It's something to do with blood with me anyway, but it's something to do with the sound of the blood going through the veins makes me feel sick.
It's not good.
I'm happy that I haven't watched.
I mean, it must feel at this stage like you have. Like you've seen all of them from Chris's monologue.
I was busy watching Batman the Animated Series, and I think I made the right decision.
Oh my goodness.
I mean, I thought I gave you guys a part of the history of the Halloween franchise, but clearly, Amon, I need to sit you down and school you in Freddy Krueger.
Schooled.
Oh my God. Anyway, so... Nancy Thompson's in the first one. She's in the third one as well. And she's also kind of in the seventh one, but played by herself.
Oh, I've aged years. I have aged years.
So now that I've given you all... I've given you all the information you need. Let's make a decision, please, God. Let's make a decision. Your Jesus cannot help you now, by the way. You are beyond his powers. You're in here with me. You're all my children now, which is a Freddy Krueger quote from Nightmare on Elm Street 2. Anyway,
I do not understand that.
Let's choose one. I feel it's a bit harsh for me to impose Nancy Thompson upon you. I'm going to recommend we go with Samara Weaving.
Okay, well, I mean, we did both, and it's a great modern performance.
Yeah, we don't want some bunch of old-timey ladies up on Rushmore.
Boo! Boo ladies.
Like some black and white ladies up there. No, right. No, we don't need that. We want some Technicolor. God damn it.
Boo, yeah.
All right. So are we happy with that?
I'm happy with that.
You're going to get people throwing shit at you on Twitter. It's like, how could you not put Nancy Thompson or Ellen Ripley on your list? But I'm happy with this. This is a good Mount Rushmore. Let's look back at it.
It's a nice sort of intergenerational thing of them. A nice School of Final Girls.
Yeah, thing. I think so. So we have the Peter Nyong'o from Up.
Yes, please.
Squirrel.
Imagine tethered Doug in a little red jumpsuit. Oh, brilliant.
I'm going to tie balloons to my house. Oh my God, there's no coming back from that. The Peter Nyong'o from Us. Then we had Sydney Prescott from Scream 3.
Hey, I am a Scream 3 purist.
Okay.
It's my favorite one.
Is it?
Ooh, there you go.
I love it.
Really?
Yeah. Two words, my friend. Parker Posey.
Well, yeah, but we're not putting Parker Posey up because, I don't like what happens to her in that film. I don't like what happens to her in that film.
I don't know. It's just such good camp fun. I love Scream 3.
Yeah.
I love it so much.
Okay.
Anyway.
I'm so glad we found the one person who likes Scream 3. This is amazing. All right, so... Okay, fuck it. Sydney Prescott from Scream 3 is on Mount Rushmore. Then it was my choice, which was Laurie Strode. I'm going with the original Halloween. That's her incarnation up there on Mount Rushmore. Mm. And then we're going for Samara Weaving's...
Grace.
Gladys Grace.
What is going on? I'd love a kind of girl called Gladys. Talk about a back of my old lady. Gladys the final girl.
Hitting Freddy Krueger with a handbag.
I feel like there's an Edgar Wright film in there somewhere.
There probably is. All right. Okay, that's a good Mount Rushmore. I'm happy with that.
Honorable mention, Melissa Barrera in the recent Scream movies.
Oh yeah, she's great.
Yeah.
She's great.
She rocks. She does rock. But is she a final girl?
Well, Jenna Ortega as well, I guess.
Yeah.
Core four.
The core four.
Yeah.
Well, fuck it, why don't we just put those up in the Mount Rushmore and just be done with it? Unbelievable. All right, should we have a guest?
Yeah.
All right, if you want to have your question read out, blah, blah, blah. Okay, so who do you want? Should we have Celine Song? Should we start with Celine Song? Celine Song obviously shot to prominence a couple of years ago with I'm going to say the name of this film wrong. I'm going to get names of these films wrong.
Oh, wow.
I've gone from Up to Us or Us to Up. I'm going to say past tense. I know I am. I've got to stop myself. Past Lives, which was absolutely terrific, put her on the map, and now she's back with Materialists, which stars Dakota Johnson as a dating expert who, if you watch the trailer, is torn between her choice. Do I go with the multimillionaire Pedro Pascal who wants to woo me, or do I go with the slumpy kind of normal guy, Chris Evans, who wants to woo me? The movie's not really that at all. It is and it isn't. There's a lot more going on in Materialists than the trailer might have you believe. And we sent along Harry Stainer to have a chat with Celine Song when she was in London last week. I haven't heard this interview. It might have gone disastrously wrong. I am told it didn't. So here we go. I have no idea what they talked about, but you're about to hear it. Do please enjoy.
We are delighted to be joined on the Empire podcast by Celine Song, director of Past Lives and Materialists. How are you? You okay?
I'm good. How are you?
I am very good, thank you. Good. So yeah, coming out of this film, I felt I was very moved by it and made me feel a lot. So did Past Lives. But I had one question that I was like, I need to ask Celine about this.
Me.
So during the film, it is mentioned that there is this height surgery.
Yes.
And when I was watching the film, I was like, oh, this is cool. I like this. It's fun. And then I was like, oh, but it's not real. I then went on to a Google rabbit hole.
It's
and
real.
Then a YouTube rabbit hole. And I was like, this is a real thing.
It was a GQ article.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And I think there was one in New York Times too. So I knew that this was a thing, but I feel like, but it was a few years back.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's been growing since.
Oh, so it's like a common thing, like among...
It's getting more and more common.
I feel like, yeah, a lot of guys who are short are probably getting it. I was like, that's... I didn't realise this was a thing. It was just very like, oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Okay, so yeah, I was obviously... Past Lives was like a massive success.
Yeah.
And then your Oscars and all that. And then you're like given the opportunity to do like your next project. And I was like, this feels like... In terms of like thematically, I felt there's a lot of crossover, but also tonally, I think it feels quite different. I'm like, at what point was like the gem of the idea of this? Was it like post Past Lives, or was this something you were thinking about like way before Past Lives even got made?
Well, Past Lives got made, and then I finished working in post production, and then from there, I actually had a few months in there before it came out in a world premiere at Sundance in Utah.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, I knew that I was a filmmaker because I had just made Past Lives, but I had to wait and be in secret about that fact for a few months, where it was driving me a little bit crazy because I knew I was a filmmaker, but nobody else in the world knew. So I was like, okay, I'm going to use this energy to write my next movie. And then I thought, well, what is the story that I've always wanted to tell? Because it felt like I could make another movie. A24 and my producers, like, we're talking about, like, let's make another movie. And I was like, well, 10 years ago or so, like in my 20s, I worked as a matchmaker for 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like leaving that job because I learned so much about people in that job. I learned so much about what's actually in people's hearts on that job. I always knew that I was going to make something about it. And I had been trying intermittently for about 10 years until... I just finished Past Lives. I knew I had already made a movie. It hasn't come out. And I was like, okay, I'm going to actually try to crack this story.
Mm.
So I finished that script, and then I was going to get to make it with A24 and my producers. And then I went to Sundance for the world premiere. So the whole time that I was releasing Past Lives and getting to have that amazing run, and of course, I even got to go to the Oscars, I knew the whole time that this is going to be my next movie.
Also, the seed was there. Like, it was like, before even Past Lives had become the massive success that it was, you were like, Materialist is the next one.
Well, this is a script. This was my next movie.
Yeah,
and
that's cool.
I was so, I was thinking about it and working on it for all of that time that I got to go to the Oscars, which was amazing, in 2024. And then in March. And then the day after that, I flew back to New York City. And the day after that, I was in a scout van for Materialists.
Oh my goodness. So yeah, quick turnaround then.
Of course. I mean, it's a quick turnaround, but also like I'm putting together the movie the whole time I'm sharing Materialists.
That's so
cool. The reason
I didn't
why,
know that.
I mean, the whole time, the reason why my actors were meeting me and I got to sort of meet them and to fall in love with them as characters and then to send them the script is because of Past Lives, because they had seen Past Lives. So they were willing to meet me.
When like approaching something like this, do you... have people in your head while you're kind of like figuring it out and writing the script? So for example, like Chris's character and Pedro's character, were you already like, were they kind of like in your mind for the roles?
No, I mean.
Or did it come later, like where you're like actually chatting to actors and you're like, you've got the chemistry or like what I'm looking for this character?
Well, I think that, you know, I don't write anything with actors in mind. Mm. I usually just create the characters as they are on the page. And then I go out in search of the soulmate of that character in a way that a matchmaker might. So it's like actually very close to what a matchmaker has to do.
So this, your previous job has done your
exactly.
favor here, yeah?
So I go out there and I'm kind of like, and I got to meet these actors because of Past Lives. I was in LA and I got to sort of like have lunch or have drinks. Mm. And it would always be kind of a casual thing that I wasn't really, they weren't necessarily meeting me for this project.
Mm.
But sometime in the middle of the conversation, I think that I would just realize that they were the right person for the
role. So like you're meeting Pedro and then there's like a point where you're just like, you're Harry.
Oh,
that's really cool.
And then of course, then I go, and that's how love works, right? Mm. You kind of go and you tell Dakota, like, I think you're the soulmate of this character. I want you to read the script and tell me if you feel that way about Lucy. And then of course, like all love, she goes, oh yeah, I feel this way about Lucy. She's my soulmate. Yeah.
That's such a wonderful approach to like casting. That's like such like an organic way to like get a cast together.
Of course.
I was going to ask you about the character of Lucy, because I feel like, especially like we're sort of culturally told that like looking at like material things is almost something to be like looked down upon.
Mm-hmm.
Like a lot of films kind of tell us that it's like you shouldn't be looking after, like looking for like materialistic things.
Yeah.
I liked how Lucy as a character wants materialistic things and is also like still very empathetic and still like very lovable as a character. And I was wondering like, how do you approach that like balance with like a lead character?
Well, I think it's because she's going through something that lets all of her materialism sort of fall apart, right? Throughout the film, you're getting to see the way that she is completely in control or seems to be completely in control in the beginning of the film. And because of the journey that she goes through, she's a hero of the journey. So I think that by the end of it, we see the way that the things that she believed about her life, about love, dating, all those things are not going to hold at the end of the film. My joke is always that the Lucy in the beginning of the film would look at Lucy at the end of the film and say, "What an idiot." Right? And then, of course, Lucy at the end of the film would look at Lucy in the beginning of the film and say, "You poor sucker, you poor idiot." Right. So I think that what's important more than anything is to really follow the story of this character and everything that she goes through that changes her. Right. That's the sort of basics of drama. You get to see a hero's journey. You see the way that everything that she believes in the first, 15 minutes of the film is, of course, going to all come apart over the course of the film. And you get to see all of those things break down and for her to be reborn as someone who can, who believes different things and who actually is going to make decisions that are very heroic. And I don't think that she would have had the courage to make those decisions at the beginning of the film.
Yeah, I think especially as well, a through line that I saw with this and Past Life was like a big part of both of them are even with Materialist, as much as looking forward at relationships, there's a big part of it that's looking back at a previous relationship of like between Chris and Dakota. And I was like, what is it? And I've been thinking about this ever since, which is like, what is it about that like we look back on relationships almost with like rose tinted glasses and it's like the fights don't seem as harsh through those glasses. And I was like, what do you think that is about like us looking back on our past relationships that way?
Well, I think it's quite different for the character Nora and Haesung in Past Lives because they never actually got to actualize their relationship. They didn't. They were never in a relationship, right? They just had crushes on each other as children. I mean, barely, right? And they held hands once in a car. You know, like so for them, they're not quite exes, right?
That's always it's a weird space.
Yeah, they're friends, right? They're friends who may have been romantic, but it just never happened. So in comparison, John and Lucy in Materialist, they're fully exes. They fully had a relationship. I do think that history, as in the time that we spend with somebody, good or bad, is always going to be something that leaves a mark. Right. So I think that it's more about how much I respect time.
Yeah.
Right. Because and also the respect the ins and outs of a day or like kind of like the more mundane side of our lives where it's like, yeah, I think going to the grocery store together is can be tremendously romantic if you're doing it with the love of your life.
Yeah.
You know?
I like that aspect of it where it's like you're almost looking back on something so simple.
Oh, yeah.
Or even like the argument outside of the car. There's an argument outside of the car. And I was like, you're looking back on this almost through like a lens of like, it's hard to watch, but it's almost like, oh, you were a couple. Like
you
did what couples did. You were real.
Of course.
I also was like, just thinking throughout it, I was like, this feels almost like a step up from Past Lives in terms of like budget and in terms of like, I guess like a bigger acting ensemble as well. And I was like, is that the direction you see yourself going in as a director? Would you like to return to something smaller like Past Lives or... I just noticed that in terms of like the jump from Past Lives to this, it's the same heart and soul, but a slightly bigger a budget, I guess.
Well, to me, it's always about just the heart and soul of it for me, right? Because it's like I'm interested in making a movie at whatever budget or whatever situation or anything, as long as it's something that I know that I'm going to have creative authority on, right?
So, yeah, so
to me,
don't
I'm like,
feel,
I think that. The truth is that like that is ultimately the thing that matters the most to me, that I get to make the movie I want to make.
Yeah.
Because here's the thing, to make a movie, it is at a minimum 3 years of your life.
Yeah.
And I don't really take vacation. I don't really take the weekends off. For me, it's a 24/7, 365 days event. So for me to feel that dedicated and that burning for something, I need it to be really personal to me. And I need it to be something that I believe in. Deeply as the thing that only I can make. What that means is that also And so I'm like, I'm willing to do all kinds of things just for the creative authority on that project, right? But I think that when it comes to the budget of it or whatever, the actual material reality of making a movie, I think that more material things, if it can stay, if it can mean more freedom,
yeah,
more creative freedom, absolutely, I welcome it, right?
Yeah. No,
but if it means that having bosses, that's not me, then I think that I'm a lot less interested.
Okay, no, I understand.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, yeah. I totally get you. I also wanted to ask about modern dating. I feel like this is one of the first films that I was like, this captures the whole feel of, I live in London, I know what the modern dating scene's like. And I was like, it feels like it really captures that. And I was like, is that something you really wanted to like put under the magnifying glass in this? Because I know it's obviously framed through a matchmaker, but there were so many parts of it where it's like people going on like multiple dates and trying to find a person that fits in this box. And it's like, we're kind of...
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm really interested in talking about it openly. Dating is a game that we're all playing in pursuit of love. So dating is interesting to me in that way, when I'm talking about love and especially romantic love, specifically in this movie. I would say that dating is of great interest because it's a game that we're all asked to play. And I'm very concerned about the way that dating as a system has been becoming something that is making actually love very difficult, right? Because I feel like so much of the movie is called Materialists. And this movie is about the way that we commodify and objectify each other. And of course, it's going to result in also commodifying and objectifying ourselves too. And the truth is that any commodification or objectification of human beings is going to result in dehumanization. So I think that I'm interested in dating as a thing that we're being asked to do, supposedly in pursuit of love, right? We're asked to swipe, supposedly in pursuit of love. But why is it that the language around it is still so algorithmic and there's so much math and there's a minimums, right? The maximums, this is what I need, this is what I want. And you're like, and so much of it is about value too. And I think about this in terms of like the most important line in the whole film is, I'm not merchandise, I'm a person. And a merchandise cannot love another merchandise, but a person can love another person. And the thing about merchandise is that when we treat ourselves as merchandise, then of course we get starting to think about each other and ourselves as value objects. So you want to be desired by somebody who's valuable so that you can feel value.
Yeah.
Right? And you're like, well, you guys are talking like you're actually objects, you're merchandise. But in fact, it's just true that we're all people. And people do not have to have high value to earn love. People just deserve love because we exist, right? And I think that to me is always the fundamental, the sort of the bedrock of this film. This movie is very much about the way that love is something that is the only cure we know, actually, to human loneliness, which is a problem that we all deal with, right? And the thing is, like, you know, you can try to buy little boo-boos and go on social media and, you know, like buy a Cartier ring or like, you know, drive a Ferrari as a ways to maybe try to solve the problem of loneliness. But at the end of the day, the only thing that has actually proven to be the only cure, the ancient cure to loneliness, is two people looking at each other and then understanding each other and then saying, I completely accept you and I love you, right? And the truth is that if that is something that it seems to me that I'm very concerned with how no one seems to question the price of a Birkin bag. Like if someone says this is what Birkin bag costs, no one seems to question its value. But I hear over and over again, people ask me, is love really worth it? People question love all the time. They're like, what is it worth? Is it valuable? Should I even want it? Is it even worth wanting? Is it worth the risk? And I'm like, why is it that when it comes to the one salvation we have, to the fundamental problem of being human, which is loneliness, when it comes to that one thing, everybody seems to question that, right? And I think it's because of the way that capitalism has tried to colonize our hearts. And we see it happen to us, right? It's become so all-encompassing that it's trying to eat everything. But I know that love will triumph, right? Love will always be there. Just because you're rich and in control and educated and powerful, it doesn't mean that love is going to find you better.
I think that's a lovely sentiment to end the interview on. That's really sweet.
Love is free. Love is freedom.
Perfect. Thank you, Celine Song, for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
That was absolutely wonderful.
Okay, that was Harry talking to Celine Song, and we'll be talking about Materialists later on in the show. Right now, let's get into movie news. What has been happening, folks, and where has it been happening? What would you like to talk about?
Should we talk about Marty Supreme, which got its first trailer this week? Very excited for this.
Yes. What is Marty Supreme?
So, an interesting sort of separation happened between the Safdie brothers. Safdie brothers, of course, did Uncut Gems. They did Good Time. They've been making kind of indie, low-budget films for a really long time, but have grown in stature and have grown this kind of massive A-list fan base of people just dying to work with them, amongst them Adam Sandler and Robert Pattinson. But they parted ways, reasons for which have been largely undiscussed, but they are now doing sort of solo projects, and this is their sort of first big endeavors on their own. Bernie Safdie is making Smashing Machine with Dwayne Johnson, big wrestling biopic.
And being the bad guy in Happy Gilmore too.
And being, amongst so many other things, amongst being like a Jedi in Obi-Wan and a hot dad in Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. That man's acting career is fascinating.
Yep.
I digress. He's doing that in That Corner, which is out in October. In December, this film is out. This is from Josh Safdie. This stars Timothy Chalamet as Marty Mizier, a ping pong star who's destined for possible greatness. Also stars Gwyneth Paltrow as a older movie star who he kind of holds a candle to. And it's about his endeavors and his strive for greatness as this master ping ponger. But cracking cast in this. Cracking cast.
We've got eclectic
also. Yes, we've got, I mean, put this on your Mount Rushmore. We've got Fran Drescher, Tyler, the Creator, Gwyneth Paltrow, someone I hadn't heard of, but is like very much a spotlight in this. Odessa Azayan. I haven't seen her in much, but seems to be on the uppy up.
The uppy up.
But also, I'm fascinated about this. I read an interview with the cinematographer. The name escapes me, and I'm sorry, but apparently there's something like 140 characters in this film.
Whoa.
Yes. And there's promising things like you've never seen anything like this before. I don't know how you get 140 characters in a film about ping pong. But based on this, it's so interesting to see the parallels between the two brothers, because they are both clearly vying for prestige, like these big buzzy casts. You know, there's Oscar talk about both of these already. And it's just interesting to see what both are bringing to the table. Both look quite similar in terms of like aesthetic, but this seems to be a little bit more playful. Timothy Chalamet going for the light, fun, cocky ping pong player rather than like Dwayne Johnson going for his big awards performance, I feel like, with Smashing Machine. But yeah, this trailer looked like a lot of fun.
Yeah. Abel Ferrara in it as well.
Oh, bloody hell. Why not?
Yeah.
I really like this trailer. I am fully in. Have you guys like seen some of the ping pong clips that circulate around Olympic time when you see these just incredible players going at it? It's really spectacular.
Wow.
And you get a little glimpse of it in that trailer. I hope that we get a considerable amount of watching these guys do their thing, because when they're on form, it's really exciting to watch.
Mm.
Yeah. And we all know how Timmy likes to prepare vigorously for
Timmy
his roles.
Two bats. He'll have one bat in one hand and one bat in the other hand, and boom, 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 boom.
So yeah, just on that level, I'm excited. But the trailer was great.
Yes.
This is great news for ping pong, especially after the restaurant chain of the same name had to close a couple of weeks ago. Did you see that?
Very sad
news.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
I used to use that one on South Bank quite a lot.
Oh, love ping pong. It's gone.
R.I.P.
Yeah. But this is good news for ping pong. So there we go. Yeah,
what
Timmy
did they serve
meats.
At this ping pong restaurant? I don't think
it was dim sum. Yeah, okay. Do you like dim sum?
And then some. Hey. I'll leave.
I don't think I've ever tried.
You've never tried dim sum?
No.
Okay. Mm. All right. Well, we'll have a Nightmare on Elm Street marathon, and we'll get some dim sum.
Love this for me.
Get your coat. I'm on. You've pulled. All right. There was more Timmy Two Meats news. Did you see this news that broke this week that he's re-teaming with James Mangold on a film called Highside, which is a heist movie set in the world of motocross.
Ooh.
So,
what is it set in, Chris?
Motocross. Hello, motocross. I don't know. No one's ever said it like that before. So, Timmy Two Meats might play someone called Billy, who's a traumatized former MotoGP racer, whose estranged brother, that might be Timmy Two Meats if you don't know, recruits him to help with a series of audacious bank robberies. And there's an FBI agent on their tail. So that's exciting. Now, I know that Chalamet is currently shooting Dune Part 3, which is obviously exciting. James is on holiday right now, but I'm surprised he hasn't crashed through that wall just to go, Dune! And this looks like it might happen after that. And that means that the Dawn of the Jedi movie is still in the distance.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, what will it take to make a Star Wars film work at this stage?
Yeah. Who knows?
Who's to say?
Who's to say? That's exciting news.
Yeah.
There we go. Everyone's happy.
Everyone is
anything
happy.
Anything else you want to talk about?
There's been a couple bits of Marvel news.
Oh.
So Sony released a little snapshot, day one of Spider-Man Brand New Day, with Tom Holland in Spider-Man suits filming in Glasgow. Mm. And a number of civilians came out to watch, which was really fun. Before they released this video, there's a lot of stuff flying around on socials. There's one video which I saw, they're shooting a stunt. And one Glasgow person goes, "It's fucking Spider-Man!" And it was brilliant.
I'm sorry, where are they from?
I knew you were going to do this. You always do this.
Please do it again. And it's not a Glasgow person. It's Glaswegian. Glaswegian, that's what you call them.
What did I say?
You said Glasgow person.
You know, I want to get the name right.
Technically, I'm not incorrect.
In fairness, they might not have been from Glasgow. They might have travelled all the way to see Tom Holland. So maybe they were from wherever Amon's.
Wow. Just trying to deliver like a simple piece of news and absolutely ripped to shreds.
I'm not ripping anyone to shreds. I'm curious to know. Please give me a backstory for this person. Where are they from?
I'm hoping we get to learn the backstory if this person makes it into the film, which I genuinely hope they do. All right. After that remark, because it gave me a lot of joy.
Right.
But yes, excited about this film. Less excited that so many MCU elements are going to be a part of it. Punisher has been announced. Hulk has been announced. Mm. Scorpion.
Oh, like, yes, that's right. I don't think we talked about that on a previous episode. And Ruffalo is going to be in this as Hulk.
Oh. Yeah, like part of the reason I loved the ending of No Way Home is because there's no tech, there's no Iron Man, it's just Peter being a lone Spider-Man, and I wanted a story that was focused on that. So the fact that we're getting all these outside elements makes me a little hesitant, but we shall see.
We shall see. Of course, part of the Sony Marvel deal is that any of these Spider-Man movies, the ones that cross over to the MCU, usually come with a big heavy hitter. And I was wondering who the big MCU heavy hitter was going to be, and it does seem like it's going to be Ruffalo. Mm-hmm. So that's interesting. John Bernthal is in it as Punisher, as you have said. There's going to be a lot of other things going on besides as well. I'm excited about it. As things stand, it is the next Marvel movie. It is the only Marvel movie we're going to get between now and Avengers Doomsday next December. It's got a lot of work cut out for it, but I guess they were filming in Glasgow and they knew they were going to be out in the streets with Glasgow people going, "Oh, look, there's someone who's come to our fair city. He dressed as a spider. What is that? Is it red and blue? Little ensemble? It's very nice, isn't it? Should we welcome him in the traditional Glasgow manner?" No, don't do that! Oh my God, they've headbutted him. They've headbutted Tom Holland. Oh no.
Yeah.
Anyway. I think they knew that there were going to loads of pap shots and lots of people on their phones, so they decided to embrace that by releasing something official. So that's good. Yeah. All right, that's exciting. Yeah. Anything else?
The other bit of Marvel news is Ryan Reynolds has teased that Deadpool will be in Avengers Doomsday by graffitiing over an Avengers symbol.
Yes.
So
I saw this.
Yeah.
I saw this.
I don't imagine he'll be in it for much, but given what I predict will be a fairly heavy film because of the doom of it all, it will be nice to have a burst of Deadpool to liven things up.
How is he going to work?
I have no idea. Call the Russos.
All right. I'll try.
You probably could.
They're not picking up.
Marvel Jesus will be in Avengers Doomsday.
Turns out the number they gave me was just a pizza shop. God damn it. All right. That's that. I'm intrigued. There are rumors going around that there's going to be more casting announced soon for Doomsday. I imagine that was Reynolds getting out ahead of that, or responding to
more chairs.
As the news editor of Empire, the last announcement, which happened the day before we went to print, and the announcement took something like 8 hours.
This is my
loved that.
It's my life, Beth.
For me,
Feige has this studio bugged. And he goes, when have they stopped recording? Yes, sir. Excellent. Release the news.
Yeah. When's the print deadline? Oh, 12 hours. Right, well, we're going to take up half of that.
That's exactly
announcing the biggest casting news of the year.
Yeah.
Thanks, Kev.
Well, Feige, we're on to you. You've made a powerful enemy of us on this day. But anyway, we're excited about your new films.
Yes, please
keep fighting the good fight. Yeah. Yes. Anything else?
I want to do some news just for me.
Should we leave the room?
maybe other people in this room. I'm very excited that K-pop Demon Hunters is getting a limited but actual theatrical release.
Really?
Yeah.
Hey!
Sing-along screenings across the nation.
What?
And others. And thank goodness, Netflix really missed a trick putting this straight onto the platform. It's really good fun. The animation is out of this world. The bangers be banging. Bring it to the big screen, for goodness sake. So it's getting, I actually don't know when it is coming to cinemas, but it is getting a limited theatrical release. And I really do think people need to go see this film. It's so much fun. So much fun.
I haven't seen it yet, so I'm excited about that. That's good. Maybe I'll pop my K-pop cherry. On the big screen.
It's gonna be golden.
The list of films that Netflix should have released in the cinema keeps getting longer and longer and longer. I'm happy that I have started.
Happy Gilmore 2 being one of them. They honestly would have cleaned up.
I need to watch. I started K-pop Demon Hunters. I haven't finished it yet, weirdly. I started watching it a couple of days.
And you know why? Because you watched it at home.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
23rd and 24th of August.
Yeah, you will not be able to leave. Well, you can leave during the big screen experience. Yeah.
Cinema doors will be locked as soon as you enter. No, I'm looking forward to finishing it. Maybe I will wait to finish it on the big screen.
Yeah.
Because I was having a lot of fun.
All right. Well, that's exciting. That's exciting stuff. Are you excited about this? James Gunn has announced that he is writing his next Super Family, I believe that's what he's called it, Super Family movie. Mm. So it sounds like, and he's going to direct it as well, but it sounds like it's not going to be a Superman sequel outright. Superman's going to be in it, and I'm guessing will be the main character, but it's going to be about other characters as well. Mm. So what do you think about
that? I like this. You know, I said a similar thing about Batman, I think on this podcast, something ago, in terms of what they should be doing going forward. Give us more of the Bat family. That's something that has not been mined nearly enough on the big screen. It's a similar thing for Superman and his family. So I'm glad that is where James Gunn is shifting his focus to.
Who do you think will be in that movie?
Probably Connor Kent, who has had many different interpretations. I think the one which I'm thinking of, he's half a clone of Lex Luthor and half a clone of Clark Kent. So they could do that. And then obviously Supergirl would have been out by that point. So that means Superman, Supergirl, Connor Kent, Superboy.
So hang on, is Connor Kent Superboy?
Yeah.
Is that not a lot to explain? if you're going, so Lex Luthor is clone Superman.
Imagine if they did the same that they did with Superman and it just started with Superboy there. No explanation, no origin story. Just like, yeah, I'm Superboy.
Three days ago, Superboy was discovered.
Yeah.
Now, I don't, because they've already set up the clone Superman idea with the Hammer of Bavaria in the first Superman. So
hang on, because I used to read, when I was a kid, I read Superboy comics,
mm-hmm.
But I thought he was like Clark. I thought he was Kal-El, but plucked from a different timeline.
No.
He's a clone. Is that canonically what it is? He's a clone.
In the versions of him that I am thinking of, he's a clone.
Okay.
Because I'm thinking of Smallville.
Beth, just will to live checkup. How are we doing?
I checked out during the Halloween. It's just been like birds tweeting in my head. I wonder if we meet whoever it's going to be about in Peacemaker, because isn't that like a multi-dimensional thing?
So it is a multi-dimensional type thing.
So I wonder if they set up a little hint or something.
Oh, that's exciting. Mm. Last but not least, Noah Centineo, which I believe is how you pronounce it, is going to star in the Rambo origin movie from the director of Sisu, Yamari Helander. And he's going to star as young Sly Stallone. How do we feel about this?
Shrug.
Shrug?
Yeah.
Shrug and sigh. I guess that there's only of the kind of younger crowd of rising stars, there's only a certain number of them that could fit that mold. And I guess he is tall, dark, and muscly and great.
He is.
Yeah.
He is.
On a looks level, it works, but my excitement for the Rambo franchise has long dissipated. It's going to take a lot to get me pumped up for this one.
Get the kids from Son of Rambo in. Who was in that again? Was that Will Poulter?
It was Will Poulter and Bill Milner.
Get them back.
That'd be amazing. I'm excited. Yamari Helander's involvement makes me think that this might actually be all right, because that man knows his way around an action sequence. My concern with this is, I think we discussed this in the pod before, is that the Rambo origin movie is First Blood. I don't understand. I mean, yes, you could do Rambo in Vietnam, but I don't know. Do we really need to see it? I don't know. But,
exactly.
Yeah.
Well, on that happy note, that is it for the news section. Should we have our final guests of the week? They are a married couple. They weren't married when we started interviewing them, but they got on so well. No, they were married beforehand. It is Alison Brie and Dave Franco, of course, who have starred in movies before. Did Dave Franco direct that film, The Rental?
Yeah, I think so, that she was
in. He wasn't in it. He wasn't in it, but he directed it. And Alison Brie was in it. It's a good movie. With, I think, if I'm right in thinking, a young Jeremy Allen White.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, Dan Stevens, Alison Brie, good cast. Creepy little fucking movie. We'll add it to the long list.
Why are you trying to traumatize me?
I don't know. To quote Fight Club, I wanted to destroy something beautiful.
Oh, you think I'm beautiful? Thank you.
No comment. We'll let the internet decide once I get hold of the footage. But anyway, what was I talking about?
You're talking about together. You're talking about together.
Together, yes. All right. Thank you. Thank you. So in Up, Lupita Nyong'o plays Gladys.
So silly.
All right. Anyway, so Alison Brie and Dave Franco, they have worked together on horror movies before. And now they are starring in together as a couple who, how do I describe this? Because I haven't seen it, so I'm really going off what I've read on the internet. Fuse together on a genetic, molecular level, and they're not entirely sure why, and they try and figure it out. And
codependent body horror.
That's it. Codependent body horror. Thank you indeed, Bethany. And it's, again, I haven't seen it, but my understanding is it is deeply fucked up and well worth your time. And we sent along Mike Munzer, a man who, of course, knows his way around the evolution of horror. We sent him to talk to Alison and Dave together, and a merry time was had by all, but they did not fuse together on a molecular level, no matter how much Mike tried. Enjoy.
Dave Franco and Alison Brie, hello. Welcome.
Hi.
First of all, just tell us a little bit about what kind of intrigued you guys about this script. What led you to want to do this project and together as a pair as well?
Yeah, I mean, we are generally drawn to things that are at least attempting to do something different that we've never seen before. Yeah. And the horror set pieces in this script were just so innovative and ambitious as hell, where we were like, I don't even know how we would pull this off, but that's exciting.
Yeah, and the way that it all tied back to the themes of the movie, this movie is an exploration of fears of monogamy, codependency. So we just loved that all of the horror set pieces were tied into the exploration of those themes, and they build on each other really beautifully through the course of the film.
So did you immediately kind of think, we should do this together as a
yes. Yes. I mean, Dave read it first and basically sent it to me and was like, we have to do this together.
We just figured our real relationship could lend itself to the relationship in the movie, where these characters have been together for over a decade. And hopefully when you're watching us on screen, you can kind of feel that history there.
Our relationship is not at all like
right.
the relationship.
We should clarify that.
But still, the meta quality
yes.
is there.
If anything, it's like these characters are kind of at odds most of the film.
Yeah.
But we wanted to make sure that there was like this underlying love between them. Yeah. Because when you've been together with someone that long, no matter how difficult the relationship is, there is still a basis of love there. And so that was something that we really wanted to infuse in there.
Yeah, obviously you are playing characters, but was that weird? Kind of, you know, those kind of moments of tension between those characters.
It was weirdly not
weird. I know. Yeah. These are like annoying answers, like where...
I know.
It, like...
No, it could be. I suppose it could be quite therapeutic as well, right?
You would think that, like, oh, maybe if we're like harnessing these deep, like, feelings and we're like letting it out on screen, but
cathartic.
We're just acting.
No, I think it was more like Dave said, because our relationship is so different from that of the characters in the movie, we weren't taking any of that stuff home
sure.
using it therapeutically for ourselves. It was more like the fact that we are together in real life gave us that trust so that we could take these big swings in the movie and we do some really weird stuff and kind of like gave each other permission to take these big risks or take some anger, threw the characters out on each other, but it wasn't personal.
No, if anything, we just felt lucky that we were at the end of each day, we're like, oh, thank God we have never gone through what these characters are going through.
Yeah, absolutely. They do go through a lot. What was it like on set, particularly some of those moments of kind of body horror and filming those bits?
It was
interesting.
Yeah. It was wild. It was, I mean, there were certain days where we would come to set early in the morning, and from the very first take, our energy had to be at 100 and it had to stay there the entire day. And pretty much every day, I was definitely getting injured. You know, I think about the shower scene where I'm fully nude, my character is unconscious, and I'm flinging my face against porcelain walls, and that really hurts. But we were just so excited about the footage that we were getting, and just felt like, kind of going back to what we were saying earlier, just felt like something different that people will hopefully look at and be like, oh my God, I've never seen this on screen before. And so our excitement just kind of superseded any pain that we were feeling.
Is there one day on set particularly that stands out to you guys as being a particularly kind of challenging one? Or
definitely.
Most days.
The day that we were shooting the reciprocating saw scene we were attached for upwards of 10 hours. So we were sitting together for 3 hours just to get a prosthetic attached to our arms. We couldn't be further than an inch away from each other. I mean, not even an inch. We didn't want to damage the prosthetic. In addition to that, Dave was taped to a chair. I'm sitting on his lap all day. It was just sort of a trying day.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, when someone's sitting on your lap for 10 hours, regardless of how petite they are, it hurts. It also really, it takes a toll. And so what was nice about us kind of being in a real relationship is that we could kind of surpass
the niceties
politeness.
And just be like, honey, you gotta get up. And I'd be like, yes.
I love you, but adjust your weight somehow, please.
It's true. So we both just sort of had to take turns being uncomfortable that day. But you're right. We didn't have to spend those moments in between being like, how's your wife? How's-
Oh, God. Yes. What about those moments of your bodies kind of contorting and flipping? And like, how was that done on set?
Well, I should give credit. I had a great contortionist
yes.
double
oh,
for
cool.
a couple of the major back bends
yeah.
that took place.
But then there was some wire work on us where there would
we're
be like
attached
one
attached to a wire around our waist or chest or Dave's ankles.
Mm-hmm.
Either it was providing resistance so that, you know, we could fight against it, or we were just fully getting yanked down the gravel driveway.
Yeah. Wow. So a lot of stuff was done practically by the sounds of it on set.
Yeah. A lot of it, yes.
Fantastic. Almost everything was done practically and then had an element of visual effects over it.
At least had a basis of practicality.
A couple big set pieces that were VFX only.
Are you guys good? Are you squeamish with kind of body horror and gore and that kind of thing?
We love it.
We love it. Yeah. I'll watch some stuff through my fingers, but I'm enjoying, that's the fun of it. Yeah. I like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Are you guys horror fans generally then?
Oh, yes.
Dave, you've directed The Rental as well, right? So has that always been there for you, that love for
definitely
making horror?
Yeah, as a viewer, there's nothing I love more than a good horror movie. And I think when I directed that film, and that was my first one, people were surprised that I was going into that genre because I think a lot of people know me from the comedies I've been in. But it's so great because in horror, the stakes are so high. You know, this is life and death and crazy weird shit is almost expected within the genre. And so as a filmmaker, you can take big swings stylistically and you can really put your own stamp on one of these movies.
Did you guys, was there ever a thought that you would like to direct this movie? Or was that kind
No.
Because it really came to us as this package deal from our writer-director, Michael Shanks. And then we came to him, we answered back with another package deal of being we'll be in it together and we'll be producers on it. That was our reciprocal package.
But Michael Shanks, our writer-director, he has an extensive VFX background where he actually did 150 of the VFX shots in this movie himself while he was editing
of the sell because, as you can imagine, this was an incredibly ambitious shoot. The script had all of these beautiful set pieces in them, and then we knew that we only had 21 days to shoot the film, which would be impossible without someone with that VFX background. And with our budget, we just couldn't have afforded to pay someone to do all those shots.
Is it a risk kind of commercially doing something that is as kind of extreme as this in terms of the body?
Definitely.
There was
one moment on set when, without giving too much away, we're both naked and pressed together.
Without giving too much away, we're naked.
Yeah, I promise I'm not naked in every scene in this movie.
He is naked
every story so far.
But we're both naked, pressed together, doing some weird shit. And during that day, we were like, if this doesn't work, this is a career ender.
But I think what drew us to the project was the risk.
Yes.
I feel like as actors, we seek out risk. And that's how you know that it's an exciting project. If it scares you a little, if you're risking something, you know,
because when
it
works, it's what makes it feel special and unique.
Do you think, because obviously last year there was stuff like The Substance too. Like, do you think is horror having a bit of a moment right now?
Yeah.
Is this something that people are really embracing?
I think it's been a handful of years now where it's been like the one consistent genre that are drawing big crowds.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, with The Substance, that's been paving the way specifically for body horror, where it was nominated for multiple Oscars, including Best Picture. And it's kind of making people just acknowledge and accept that this is a real genre that people need to take seriously. And
treat the filmmakers with respect.
I've always thought that with horror and comedy, right? They're both genres that get kind of looked down upon.
Sure.
Yeah.
And you guys juggle both in this movie. Like, do you think there is a parallel? Is there a connection between making comedy and horror, do you think?
I mean, I do think both comedy and horror, they deal on a very, like, with very high stakes in sort of different ways, right? Sometimes comedy, fodder for comedy is taking something that's, like, sort of inconsequential and then imposing high character stakes on it. Horror is like you're truly dealing with life or death stakes and how are your characters going to get out of that? So either way, it's sort of like a heightened experience.
And I think with comedy, it's like whether you're kind of setting up a joke where it's like, okay, this that leads to this and then it pays off here. It reminds me of horror when you're setting up a scare where, you know,
It's kind of about the timing, isn't it?
It kind of is, yeah.
Yeah, and I guess you get that reaction. Have you kind of watched it with audiences? Because there is that kind of similar reaction.
Well, that's what I was going to say. The other thing they have in common is it's like they're the two best genres to watch in a movie theater with an audience. It's a communal experience. You want to laugh together. You want to experience jump scares together. I think it heightens the whole thing.
And this is a very obvious statement, but like comedy works the best and jokes work the best when they're unexpected, when they catch you off guard. Same with scares. You know, I think horror audiences are so savvy these days where they can kind of anticipate certain scares that are coming. And if you can surprise them, That's it's so rare these days.
Because there are some truly frightening moments in this movie too, right? And amongst all the body horror, some of those dream sequences and other nightmarish images. Did you kind of feel that on set that, oh my God, this is really going to work on people?
Yeah. And I mean, truly a lot of that was Michael Shanks.
Oh, yeah.
He has such, he loves horror and has such an eye for it that I feel like there were even some moments that like, I don't know, that on the page I would go, I don't know how he's going to make this work. And then when we were there shooting it, I was like, wow. Yeah.
Final questions for you guys. What are your favorite horror movies?
Oh, yeah.
Ooh.
In terms of the classics.
The Shining.
Rosemary's Baby. Alien.
Silence of the Lambs.
28 Days Later. The Thing. Yeah. The newer films. We love It Follows. Mm-hmm. Hereditary. The Danish version of Speak No Evil.
The Ugly Stepsister.
Oh, yeah.
That is gross.
Year.
That is so gross. Talk about a movie that I watched about. I kept watching it like that, but also cackling, laughing.
Yes,
what a beautiful satire.
Raw, we love.
Yeah.
Raw. Yeah, that's a great one.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Amazing. We're out of time. Thank you, guys.
Awesome.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, man.
Okay, that was Alison Brie and Dave Franco talking about Together, and we will talk about Together, or more accurately, Amon will, because he's the only one of us three who has seen Together at time of recording anyway, later on in the review section, for it is now the review section of the show. There's only one place to start. It is, of course, the meeting of Reed Richards, Johnny Storm, and Madame Web together at last.
Interesting that you're up with Johnny Storm and not Captain America now.
Well, I just figured the whole FF thing, Reed Richards shoot, there's a scene in this movie where Reed Richards and Johnny Storm meet and they don't talk about all the cosmic rays and Galactus. It's very strange. Anyway, I got past it. It was fine. I got past it in the end.
My God.
But anyway, that's while we're talking about materialists, let's turn to our very own Madame Web, Beth.
Hello.
Hello.
What do you want to know?
Everything about the movie. what it's about. You know, did you like it? Should people go see it? That sort of thing.
A
review.
I've done a few of these. That's funny, isn't it? That's funny, and I'm here.
Me, failed review. That's impossible.
What? Gladys. Celine Song. Made possible.
I fucking nearly did a spit take. I genuinely nearly did a spit take there. Oh. That's good shit.
Oh,
all right,
my
carry
God.
On.
Celine Song. We like Celine Song very much.
We do.
Celine Song made her directorial debut 2 years ago now with Past
Lives. Past tense.
Past Lives, which was Empire's Film of the Year that year.
Was it?
Yes.
Wow, because that was one of our Mount Rushmore questions that I rejected, which was Mount Rushmore of Empire's Films of the Year.
And I said one of them was Past Lives, and you just...
I wasn't listening. Yeah, I wasn't listening. You've got me. Put the cuffs on me.
Past Lives,
yes.
Which we loved very much. A real moment, a real arrival for Celine Song as a filmmaker. Loved that film so very much. This is her follow-up, a little bit of connective tissue, I would say, in that Past Lives was very much about a woman sort of wrestling between her past and present. I had a whole other sort of strand of identity running through it, and lots of other themes there. And this is a little bit different. It's about a matchmaker called Lucy, who is Dakota Johnson. She is at a wedding for one of her clients, where she meets Pedro Pascal's Harry, very moneyed, very handsome, what they refer to as a unicorn in her industry, like a very suave Pedro Pascal, you know, wonderful man.
I watched this with my wife last night. He appeared on screen. She touched my arm.
Yeah, your first mistake. She's at this wedding. She meets him, and then while she's talking to him, she also bumps into John, who is her ex-boyfriend, played by Chris Evans, who's kind of the antithesis. He's this like struggling actor, late 30s, living with housemates in this house share in New York, like really struggling. And we learn as the film goes on that they kind of fell apart because she's really driven by wealth and status. And it's this really, really interesting exploration of her work as a matchmaker. We get to enter this very robust very well observed, partly because Celine Song used to be a matchmaker. When she moved to New York, her first job was matchmaking to make rent while she was writing her plays. Fun Easter egg, actually, when they go to see one of Chris Evans' plays, one of John's plays, there is a poster for one of Celine Song's.
Oh, I thought you were going to say the dialogue they were delivering was from that play.
Good Lord, no, that would be a bit egotistical. But there's a poster for one of her plays in
I did
the
notice background. The poster, but I didn't know what it was for.
Yeah.
Okay, that's cool.
So really fun. And all of that detail and observation kind of bleeds into this world. It is really fascinating to see, you know, the kind of tick boxes that these people have for matching. There is a love triangle involved in the story. And as you mentioned in the trailer, it is marketed as that, you know, this woman who has to choose between one and the other, her kind of future aspirational life and this, you know, schlubby, lovely kind of grounded guy, you know, where will her loyalties lie? But it's so much more than that.
Yep.
And I don't want to give anything away, but there are some sort of mid-act revelations and plot developments that are really interesting and surprising and handled very well. For me, the screenplay is just what sells this for me. I really enjoyed watching the cast and the chemistry is great. Of the three, I found Chris Evans a little bit less believable as a down and out guy because he's just so handsome and clean.
Mm-hmm.
You just can't make that man dirty. I don't know how to kind of, I don't know how else to put it. Aside from
Helen has tried.
I mean, aside from literally putting soot on him, I don't really understand how you can make him look.
There's a bit where Lucy unexpectedly turns up at his apartment and he's trying to get ready in a hurry. And he starts and he's like, oh, my hair is terrible. And he's going, and she's like, dude, you look like motherfucking Chris Evans.
Do you know what I mean? It's just, of the three, and that's not to take away from his performance. I think it's lovely to see him doing something like this.
I agree totally. I think that he is someone who, you know, his choices have usually been solid. And over the last couple of years, post MCU, you know, even though he's fun in stuff like The Gray Man and, you know, fine in Red One, those choices weren't as smart as I think The Gray Man on paper just looks like a really, really smart choice. But, you know, I don't know how well it did on Netflix, but
I think,
you know,
Knives Out is still his best post MCU performance.
But, you know, he's someone who had begun to walk off the path a little bit, and now he's working with Celine Song. He's going to be in the next Ethan Coen movie, and he seems to be finally rediscovering that sort of working with kind of idiosyncratic indie directors again, and that's great.
Yeah, and I think that lends to this wonderfully. You really do believe his love for Lucy. You know, that's what it kind of boils down to. And then on the other end, Pedro Pascal is just so smooth and effortlessly charming and enigmatic and effusive, and you can totally see how she gets kind of drawn to him and attracted to him. And then Takeshi Johnson's great. She really she can go from being, you know, click, 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 yes, I can get you this man who's 6'7" and earns this and this. and it gets, you know, it gets candid. They talk about race, they talk about politics, they talk about, you know, all these are deemed to be the kind of unrealistic standards that these people have. And it's her job to manage those expectations and try to meet those expectations, even though some of them are really impossible. But, you know, she can kind of pivot very quickly between that and vulnerability, you know, when the mask slips a little bit. And it's certainly something we see in the second half of the film. You see that kind of professionalism slip away and her really wrestling with a moral quandary. And, you know, the deeper it gets, the more we kind of see Takeshi Johnson leaning into that role. And really being very emotionally intelligent and very, very compelling.
It's interesting because it's a film that doesn't have a villain necessarily. And I would say at times Lucy's a little bit down on herself. She tries to villainize herself at times. And the movie is I think, very interesting in trying to wrestle with the moral intricacies of what she does.
Yeah.
Especially with a fairly late-breaking development that I will not spoil in the film. But there's a lot more here than the poster in the trailer, which made it look like a frothy Nancy Meyers-style rom-com. And everyone was going, this is what Celine Song is doing after Past Lives.
And then
you see the film, there's complexity here.
Yes, absolutely. I can see, you know, marketing just trying to make this film very accessible.
Yeah.
But I agree, missold. And I just love Celine Song. I cannot wait to see where she goes from here. It's great that she's managed to move into something more accessible. Not that I'm saying Past Lives wasn't, but Past Lives was very specific. She's shown a lot of her other experiences for that film. So to make this as a follow-up, I think she did an incredible job, and I'm looking forward to seeing everything else that she does.
Yeah. I'm a big Past Lives fan. I was really looking forward to this. I'm in the like, not love camp. I liked it for a lot of the reasons you already said. I think the thing which I was most hung up on was you mentioned the love triangle of it all, and obviously there's much more going on, but I didn't feel the and the ah in terms of which person am I going to choose. It never really felt very much in doubt to me.
Yeah.
I was a bit surprised by that. The other thing,
I kind of disagree.
Interesting.
There was a point yesterday I saw for the first time last night, where I was like, this could end in a number of ways, and I'm not entirely sure how it's going to end. With 15 minutes to go, with 10 minutes to go, I was like, this could this could go in a number of different ways.
That's interesting. Yeah. I haven't heard that tape before.
Yeah. Well, you're hearing it now, motherfucker.
I was also surprised about the lack of humor in the film. Like, I think in any relationship, but especially in a romantic relationship, humor and being on the same wavelength in that regard is a huge thing. And there's not much of that that I felt watching this film. But I like the performances. I think Chris Evans is really charming. He does sad face really well in this film in particular. So yeah, I'll still recommend it, but it will be a softer recommend for me.
Amon gives it a soft recommend. Beth? Medium recommend, a hard recommend. What do you?
Hard
what do you
recommend.
Know? Hard recommend.
Hard recommend.
Me too. I think this is in my top 10 of the year so far. I will say caveat: I've only seen 8 films. No, I thought it was terrific. I thought it was on a par with Past Lives, and I know that not many people feel that way. But God damn it, that's what I feel.
That's how you feel.
That's how I feel.
I tell you else who gives it a hush recommend is John Nugent, who is quoted twice on the Materialist posters.
Wow!
If you see a train station, a tube stop, John Nugent Empire is quoted twice, and it's not a big poster. It's one of those like slight. It's not like a massive quad. It's like quite a small one, and John Nugent's name is on it twice.
Wow!
The review's so nice, they quoted him twice.
There we go. Fantastic. All right, 4 stars then for Materialists. Next up, Amon.
Chris,
what do you want to do? Nobody Two or Together?
Let's do Together,
but solo, because we haven't seen Together, but I have seen Nobody Two, so we could do that together, or we could do Together Solo. Together Solo, and then we'll finish off with Together. Nobody
Sounds good.
Two. Okay.
I think.
Are you okay?
Yes.
Will to Live check, Beth. Okay,
I'm ready now, straight to even out.
Take it away.
Together. Tim and Millie, that is where our focus is. They are played by Dave Franco and Alison Brie.
Oh, they were on this week's show.
They were.
That's great.
Look at that.
Wow.
They are a couple that have just moved to the countryside. While they are on a hike, they fall into a very creepy cave. It is not a cave of wonders. It is a very creepy cave. They decide to take shelter in it overnight to ride out the storm. Tim also decides to drink some nasty ass water, which is very, very ill-advised. And then once they sort of do all of that, mysterious supernatural things start happening to them. They find themselves drawn to one another in more ways than one, leading to a lot of very sticky situations, figuratively and quite literally, at multiple times in this film.
All right, good stuff.
So this is a really, really confident debut feature from Australian filmmaker Michael Shantz.
G'day, mate.
Are you in Glasgow? Glasgow.
Yeah, bloody well, Spider-Man's in. He's flying around, mate. He's bloody well doing a swing.
This is not the Michael Shanks who starred as Hawkman in Smallville, by the way. This is a different
honestly,
Michael Shanks.
You took the words right out of my mouth.
that is where my mind initially went to when I saw this name. They are two completely different people.
All right. Okay.
A lot of good work is done in the first act of this film to set up the relationship dynamic between Tim and Millie. There's love there, but there's also quite a bit of doubt. Tim in particular has a lot of commitment issues. The film actually opens on a public proposal scene that is very, very cringeworthy. Like, I wanted to crawl out of my skin. It's very, very cringeworthy.
Okay.
But it's very smart because they showcase how scary their relationship is, now scary love is, before any of the supernatural horror stuff begins to seep in. When it does seep in, It's very creepy, it's very gross, it's very, very well done. Michael Shanks has a background in visual effects, and you can tell that he does watching him put together this film. The blend of practical and CGI is really, really impressive. The sound design as well. A lot of bone cracking and snapping.
Just
very, very effective. The performances are really, really great. Alison Brie and Dave Franco are married in real life, and they bring that sort of real life energy, intimacy into these characters. It's a very physical performance. They are throwing themselves around everywhere into these very uncomfortable positions, but it's very, very impressive. Final thing I'll say, this has, there are 4 months left in this year. This has the best needle drop of the year by quite some distance.
I know what the needle drop is, and I haven't even seen this film.
It is the best needle drop of the year. It is phenomenal, spectacular. I will say no more about it. I don't want to spoil people, but it is fantastic. And the film was pretty good too.
All right. Was it scary? Did you get scared?
Yes.
Did you pray at any point during this one?
I didn't pray. I was sat next to fellow scaredy cat, Helen O'Hara. And
Helen's tough. She's from the streets. Although admittedly, they're very well-to-do streets in Northern Ireland, but still.
She's one of those Irish people, that you're saying.
Yeah, from Glasgow.
And yes, I think I was more freaked out than she was, to be fair. There's one scare that happens in the first 10 minutes I was so unprepared for. I thought that I was out, like, I was trying to time it so that my fingers were over my face at a certain point.
Oh, finger watcher.
Oh, yeah. If I get too picked out,
me too.
Absolutely.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. I think it's in the ears as well.
Oh,
I should have done
interesting.
That, but Bring Her Back. Have you seen that?
No.
Do you know what I do?
The sound design in that film.
You know what my trick is? I don't know, because I love horror, but I'm still a bit of a fraidy cat when I watch a horror film for the first time.
Mm.
So what I do is I unfocus my eyes.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
How does one even do that?
So you can still see the screen.
This is excellent podcast content.
But the video's on me right now. even now, but I'm going to put this clip
is
out.
Like the
and people are going to be like, oh
Alex,
my God,
Alex
Chris
is
Hewitt
hunked.
Is a hunk. As I unfocus my eye and then point at something vaguely in the distance.
Hang on.
And so Freddy Krueger.
Oh, yeah.
He's on screen. He's on screen, but he's blurred. So I don't know what the.
That's...
And then, scary things happened. Then I refocus my eyes.
The
good news is that it's only damaged my eyesight by 75% over the years. So you were just vague shapes to me right now.
If I'd known this, I would have watched so many more horrors.
We are actually Helen and James. You've just.
defocus your eyes. That's good. Yeah, that's a good way.
Okay.
Also, keep repeating, it's not real.
Just to be me. I genuinely close my eyes and think about my cat. If it's something really, really gnarly, I'm just like, just think about my little cat rolling around. But then when I go home and see the cat, I'm thinking about all the awful stuff that happened in the film.
How is Risky?
Oh, wow. Living her best life, man. Living her best life.
Oh,
but there's one scare in the first 10 minutes. I thought I was out of the woods, and so I lowered my fingers. I was not out of the woods. I got the full impact of it, and there was a vocal reaction, and people were laughing at me, and screw those people, because I was freaked out. But yes, it is scary.
Okay.
And quite gross. Quite like, you know, final 30 minutes of The Substance gross, a film which I will never watch ever again.
All right.
But there is some gross stuff in there.
All right, good stuff. Jesus. All right, so we gave this one 4 stars. 4 stars as well. 4 stars then for Together. And I know what we gave the next one because, Amon, you've seen this.
I think you're the
only other person besides me who has seen this film.
Oh.
And
in
the world. I think other people in the world have seen it. It is Nobody 2, which is, of course, a sequel to, let me just look it up. Nobody.
Wow, that's just incredible.
I just got my phone told me. Honestly, the way I've been going in this show, it could have been any number of films. I could have said anything. Nobody 2. It's a sequel to Five Children in It. I don't know. Nobody is a sequel to Nobody 2 is a sequel to Nobody. Starring Bob Odenkirk.
Yes.
Better Call Saul.
As Hutch. The return of Hutch.
Hutch Mansell.
Hutch Mansell. And yeah, he has been going full on with his assassin work. And he's just like, you know what? I need a break. And so he decides to take a break and reconnect with his family in yep. Plumerville, which is a place where he, when he grew up, his father took him there and he had a really, really great time. He wants to recreate those memories with his family. All looks to be going well. And then an incident at an arcade escalates. Mm-hmm. Quite understandably, because some fool decides to put hands on his daughter. That's a massive, massive no-no. And despite promising his wife that, you know, he'd keep his dark side, you know, at bay, you know, he gets mad. He roughs a few people up. And unfortunately for him, that escalates and escalates to the point where every corrupt bad guy, it seems, in the town.
And there are a lot.
is mobilized to hunt him down. It goes all the way to a crime boss called Landina, played yep. by Sharon Stone, who is annoyed that this Hutch Mansell dude is all up in their business.
Who is this nobody?
Yeah.
She says.
Yes. And yeah, she decides to come to town to exact revenge. So I enjoyed Nobody in 2021. Really enjoyed Bob Odenkirk as an action hero. I thought he was awesome. There's that bus sequence, which was very yep. highly praised and rightfully so. Timo Giorgianto directs this one, and he brings a lot of style to the action. Each action sequence has its own flavor to it, which I really, really enjoyed. There's a thing that he does multiple times where he'll let the sounds of the battle just have the audience sit with that for a few seconds, and then the camera will catch up to the madness. I thought that was really, really smart. There's one point where he goes from outside and just hearing the sounds to inside, and where all the carnage is happening, in a really, really cool, smooth transition. The best thing about this is the action. It ends with the final battle at a carnival, sort of fun fair, which is really, really fun. It feels like Home Alone, but in the Nobody universe. Really enjoyed that. I think on the script level, this film is less good. It's quite shallow with the themes that it's playing with. Like, there's a father, son, be better than your father theme that doesn't really go anywhere, just fizzles out. There's another thing with Hutch and his wife, Becca, played once again by Connie Nielsen. Good to see her have a little bit more to do in this film, especially in the final act. But there's a thing with the two of them, you know, like, you know, Becca is understandably, you've broken your promises to me, you haven't kept your wages, she's in check, she's mad, and then she isn't all of yeah. a sudden. And I yeah. found that to be quite weird. Also, the Sharon Stone of it all, they try to go very big with the performance, and it's not entertaining, but it does feel like a collection of ticks that's just thrown together that doesn't really gel into something that properly coheres. Yeah. So I had an okay time. It's less good than the first one. I wouldn't mind seeing another one, but if they're going to do that, they need to find more ways to switch it up and have better thematic storytelling, because I think that is the biggest weak point here.
Yeah, hard to disagree with that. Sadly, I enjoyed it. It's fine as it goes. I loved the first Nobody, directed by Ilya Naishuller. It was one of my favorite action movies of that year. It's a film that you can go back to and rewatch endlessly. It's just great fun. Like a more comedic John Wick. Mm-hmm. Of course, by the same writer, Derek Kolstad.
Yeah.
Whose influence, I think, is less in evidence on this movie. The script is attributed to him and someone else.
Aaron Rabin.
Yeah, I don't know. I get the feeling that maybe Derek Kolstad didn't stay the course on this movie. Mm-hmm. And you can tell everything about it is fine, but I think the story is a little slight.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the character motivations don't work for me. It's one of those, hey, the gang's all here sequels that didn't need to have the gang all here. So it's trying to find things for Christopher Lloyd to do. It's and trying to find RZA. Things for RZA to do as well. So, and it just doesn't quite work out. But, you know, but But, you know, Bob Odenkirk's always fun to watch. Mm-hmm. The action sequences are fine. Very, very good. I don't think this is Timo Chichanto in full-blown berserker mode. If you've watched his Indonesian action movies, you know, this man really knows his way around an action sequence. And it's good, solid stuff here. But, yeah, sadly for me, not as good as the first movie. But still plenty to talk about. I have recorded this spoiler special chat with Timo Chichanto, and we will be doing a spoiler special for this movie. Hopefully it'll be up next week if we can find the time to record something. I've been away unexpectedly over the last week or so, and so we're a little bit behind on supporter specials, so please do bear with us, and we will be getting up to speed as soon as we can on that front. But 3 stars you gave this one. 3 stars for Nobody 2.
Yeah,
I would go with that. Yeah, I think that's fair. 3 stars in for Nobody 2. And I hope if it's a third, that you can take all the things that work in this movie and realign and recalibrate and move forward. All right. I think on that note, that is it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week where we will be joined by... Oh, this is good. Returning to the podcast, Joaquin Phoenix.
Let's see.
Star of Ari Aster's Eddington, and
Destiny has brought him to this podcast.
And that's not all. 2 more returning champions. Chiwetel Ejiofor makes his second appearance on the podcast this year. Was he aware of that fact? No, but it is undeniable nonetheless. And I think he's the record breaking guest on the show. I think he's been on more times than anyone else. Tom Hiddleston will be back talking to those two guys together. They are the stars of Mike Flanagan's The Life of Chuck. What a time.
What a time.
What a time it is. But anyway, until then, until we meet again, until that auspicious occasion, it's time for me to say goodbye to my two colleagues of such lethal cunning. Over the course of this podcast, they proved that they were more than just another bald man and another woman. That they were, in many ways, the show's beating heart.
Oh my God. Beating veins, being held as
being
a puppeteer.
You're really not selling me on watching this film, guys, I have to say.
That's not even the worst. Well, actually, no, it's the worst bit. No, that's like the worst death. Yeah,
stays with you.
It's horrible. It's absolutely horrible. Why? But there's another bit where Freddy turns into a giant snake and tries to eat someone, and there's another bit where he turns into a TV and his arms come out the side of the TV and he goes, "It's prime time, bitch!" and smashes someone through the... I'm not. These are things that happen in Nightmare on Elm Street 3 Dream Warriors, co-written by Chuck Russell and Frank Darabont, directed by Chuck Russell, 1986.
Wow. Oh, my God, please release
me. Sorry, 1987. I got that wrong. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Anyway, it's goodbye to Amon Worman.
Peace.
We're going to get some dim sum. We're going to Freddy you up.
Oh, boy.
1, 2, Chris is coming for you. It's goodbye from Beth Webb.
Bye. Goodbye.
Goodbye. All right. And it's goodbye from me as well. I would like to round off this podcast on a personal and slightly more serious note, if you will allow me. Simon Glenn was many things. He was a talented drummer. He was a fan of Manchester United, but, you know, nobody's perfect. And he was a wonderful human being. He was the partner of my eldest niece, Gabrielle, and a loving father to her son, Tommy. Simon died suddenly last week at the age of 36. And as you can imagine, the last few days have been exceptionally tough for everybody. My thoughts are with Gabby and Tommy and Simon's family and friends. And I would like to dedicate this episode to him. Rest well, Simon. Rest well.